Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books and Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Martin James, the author of State of Bass, The Origins of Jungle Drum and Bass. So Martin, thanks for being here with me today.
That's fine, it's a pleasure.
This is a revision of a book you wrote a while ago, and so I'm wondering if you could start to talk about how you got interested in jungle drum and bass and why this book and this sort of revision right now.
Okay, so I first got interested in the whole jungle scene back when it first emerged, actually. I was a musician, a DJ, and a journalist. And around about the time the jungle was picking up, really emerging, I'd started writing for the national press. And I found myself in quite a unique position to be experiencing the emergence of something firsthand, both as a critic, but also as a punter. So I kind of felt, being immersed in the middle of this, that it really needed to be documented. And, you know the feeling when you go out and you hear something fresh and new and you want, it makes you want to be creative or makes you want to write about it or somehow respond. And by this stage, as I was mainly working as a writer, it was natural that I started writing about jungle and then drum and bass. And luckily, I met a publisher who was surprisingly interested. I say surprising because it was really early on.
So can you talk a little, let's talk about how you sort of define jungle and drum and bass. Just to sort of set this up, it's something you discuss throughout the book and the beginning of the book, but how would you define what jungle is or the origins of jungle and drum and bass?
Okay, so this is it's actually quite complex. One of the dominant stories is that jungle is a black music from the African diasporic music that comes from the sound system culture of Jamaica. What happens is when our first wave of Jamaicans arrive in Britain, they bring with them the sound system culture, but also soak up British culture. So you start developing a British black music aesthetic. And jungle was one of the first, I'd say, really strong British forms of black music. It drew on a range of different types of music, including like hip hop. It took the breaks approach of hip hop, but sped those breaks up. It took from electro. It took from God. There's a whole range of stuff. You know, you can't avoid people like Kraftwerk. You can't avoid the techno scene. A lot of the early jungle artists were trying to make techno. So it really is that this hybrid form of music. Now, the difference between jungle and drum and bass is kind of, we get into semantics. I think the very simplistic version of it is that jungle is more of a black music in that it really draws on reggae very heavily. You've got a half-speed bass line going along. And drum and bass loses the bass line. But I think it's very simplistic to then say drum and bass is therefore white. In fact, it's a very complex, and although they're both black music forms, they're simultaneously black and white in terms of who's creating the music.
Right. And so this music sort of started, as often music does, in the underground and a party scene. So what was sort of happening at that time? Can you talk a little bit about that sort of party scene, where this originated and where it really came from in creating a subculture?
So at the end of the 1980s, you start seeing an economic decline and a response to that, whereby people are embracing forms of music and a party aesthetic that goes along with it. One of the interesting things in this early stage of the Free Party was it was very punk in its approach, very DIY. So it'd be literally you'd go and scope out a building or a warehouse or a field, check that it's okay, move the sound system in and have a party. The parties were publicised with flyers. Flyers would have a number that you could call, which was a voice bank. You phone the voice bank, it tells you another number to call. And it was what happened, you'd move from place to place until eventually you find you're given the actual destination. So it was an illegal thing that was almost like cat and mouse with the police. But it was, like I said, very punk, and very DIY in its aesthetic. The positive side of that, incredibly creative. The negative side of that was, well, there's no health and safety. nobody's counting you in or counting you out. And it actually got very nasty when the police started clamping down on it. I witnessed what I talk about in the book, but there's one time when the police literally smashed up a party. I can't think of a better way of putting it. Maybe 500 people dancing in a warehouse. And they just came in and it was quite brutal, put it that way. So you've got this kind of us and them stuff thing starting to emerge, that the authorities are very anti the rave movement, as it's become known, whereas the rave scene are very politicized, highly aesthetically politicized as well as politically active. And the UK government have a series of legislations against the Free Party scene. Eventually, the final one, the Criminal Justice Act, closes down all Free Parties, effectively making it illegal to dance publicly to repetitive beats or to travel in a convoy of more than four cars, as I remember, which is kind of ironic because all music has repetitive beats. And there's many a different kind of convoy involves more than four cars. So it was a really strange thing. But effectively it drove clubs underground. You were given the choice as a rave promoter to either go the legal route and have a really quiet sound system and have a lot of the things we took for granted with the dance scene eradicated from it. Or it went into the kind of like back rooms and darker clubs that were off the beaten track. And the great thing about jungle, the really important thing about jungle, is it emerged in those spaces in London that weren't on the beaten track. They weren't a part of the underground map. So there's almost like a two maps of London. There's the underground map, but there's also a subcultural map, which is never matches up. It rarely matches up with the underground map. So the jungle scene's emerging in parts of London that you can't get to easily with the underground or often even the bus service, which created an incredible playground for people to still enjoy their cultural activities, but out of the way of the glare of the police. That they were legal, but they were in darkened spaces. So you see lots of clubs that people had ignored before or had become really unpopular, suddenly being taken over, and they turned into these amazing hotbeds of talent, spaces where you'd go in on a Friday or a Saturday when early doors when it opened, and you'd still be dancing there early doors the next day. And the floor, the ceilings were literally dripping with sweat. I mean, AWOL is the classic example of that. The ceilings dripping with sweat, everybody in there dripping with sweat, all the key people, all the main DJs, everybody's in it together. So an incredible, incredible environment. And I think kind of once in a lifetime in some ways, because I haven't actually witnessed any other scene in any other genre of music that quite had that kind of energy.
You mentioned AWOL, which stands for a way of life, and that's a really important club and sort of space. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you talk about AWOL and what it was and what it sort of meant to this scene and subculture?
So AWOL is really important as a space because you really see a transition between a form of pre-jungle sound called dark or darkcore. And you see that transition from darkcore into jungle. I'm not really keen on this idea of a straight line of one music giving way to another form of music. But you did see the popularity of one kind of music become overtaken by another kind. So both derived from the hardcore scene. The hardcore scene was a form of rave music where it used a breakbeat that was sped up, very aggressive, the same scene that the Prodigy came out of. Jungle sped, dark sped up those breakbeats even more, and then started using a lot of dystopian ambience, a lot of minor keys, a lot of basically these producers, these kids in their bedroom are starting to sample their favorite films. You know, so lots of horror films are suddenly in this music. But it kind of felt, whereas hardcore had a very positive vibe to it, dark didn't feel positive in the same way. It was quite heavy. And in the process, in those first maybe 20 weeks of AWOL, you see the transition from dark of Four Hero and those artists into the more of a junglist sound, where the sound system culture starts to become much clearer. The jungle, like I said, the reggae bass line becomes much more prominent. It's not necessarily the first place to have played this music, but you can see it's a really interesting to have seen it in AWOL, that journey from one to another. And by the end of AWOL, you really have got something that's picking up on the dancehall reggae sound. So you're almost seeing a journey within reggae going on as well, that translates from an early, almost like a rock steady vibe. By the time the last few months of AWOL, it's gone full journey to a full on dancehall reggae vibe, and a much heavier but really joyous. You know, it's hard to kind of put your finger on it or just to say how this music was ecstatic. You know, you a tune would drop and you'd just be, it would be amazing. That amazing feeling, your hair standing on the back of your neck and you just want to jump. And it's something, you know, that most people experience in that when they're teenagers. But I was a writer in my 30s, so to have the unexpected pleasure of being a critic suddenly in the middle of the floor jumping up and down to this incredible music, could I defy anybody to listen to jungle and not want to dance?
And another thing you talk about is that reggae jungle sort of taking control, armed and dangerous. You talk about and the role of race. So can you share a little bit about what you saw and what you write about with that?
Okay, well, one of the interesting things about the jungle raves, the jungle raves become typified as being spaces that are shut down to certain people. So white men became scared of going to jungle raves, which was crazy, which was absolutely insane. Funnily enough, I was talking to Brian G from V Records recently about this, and he said what it was young black men in England, or young black men were walking with a swagger. They had the swagger, and the swagger scared white boys. But white girls were still going to these raves. It was a kind of a strange, it was a very strange fear. It was a form of racism that has existed in Britain for a very long time and exists today. The fear of the white, of the black man, certainly the black youth, the idea that all young black men are in gangs. And so this was kind of implanted right into the heart of our understanding of jungle. Now, when I talk about the jungle takeover or the kind of the reggae takeover, really, what I'm saying is more of an aesthetic that it became more pronounced in its dancehall style. But at the same time, there was a perceived threat for a lot of people who found the drum and bass scene to be less threatening. Now, I'm not going to say that, I don't say that the drum and bass scene is any less of a black form of music. It draws very heavily on jazz. It draws heavily on funk and draws heavily on soul. But it was perceived to be less threatening for a white audience. Now, this was kind of introduces very bizarre and kind of complicated race ideas within the scene, because the only space I experienced racial intolerance or saw it firsthand was in the media, in the way that the scenes were depicted. Now, when on the one hand you've got jungle that's being depicted as almost being stupid music, and the other hand and threatening music, and the other hand you've got drum and bass as being perceived as being intelligent music. So it's kind of it's a split in music that reminded me of when Sgt. Pepper came out. And Sgt. Pepper was this concept album. The Beatles announced they're never going to play live again. Here's an album you've got to listen to on your headphones in the privacy of your bedroom and immerse yourself in the concept. The great rock concept is born. And it's the antithesis to the single. The single is a much more communal form of music, only communal delivery form. And so dance music is the single. The dance music is driven by the single. It's driven by community. It's driven by the dance floor. Pop music is driven in the same way. What happens in that process is that the conceptual rock becomes prioritized over the disposable dance music. That in itself, I think, is an inherently racist idea about music. Most black music is treated as being disposable. So what we start seeing in the media is this prioritization over certain types of artists. So Goldie is supported because he's clearly seen to be a long-term album artist, yet let's say Shy FX doesn't get the same respect because he's being very much driven by singles. And you start seeing that very much in the media. And increasingly, the media of the 90s was responding to this scene by depicting versions of themselves. Now, I was a journalist in mainstream publications. I wrote for magazines all over the world. And I honestly say, in all my years in Melody Maker and Music Magazine and Mix Mag, DJ, NME, Select, all the key big magazines of the era, I probably saw about three, maybe four people of colour working in all that time. So really what's happening with the media is we were redefining that form of music as in our own image. So increasingly you start getting white artists being prioritized over black artists. So that's one of the media forms that was going on. At the same time, you have very much more pernicious racism going on in the clubland. where you would in the West End of London, the central clubs, they put a ban on breakbeat music. This is something that still happens in this country now, where councils ban certain kinds of music in a city if there's a perceived problematic audience. So an idea of problematizing black music is always a key theme. So breakbeats are banned. Breakbeats are banned because that's the music of that's associated with rave, but more specifically, it's associated with jungle. Now, people weren't going to small clubs for rave, but they were going to small spaces for jungle. And you had this crazy situation where you'd have the producers and the DJs of the scene standing outside in queues, not being allowed into these clubs when their own music was being played inside. So basically there was a junglist ban. Now, to me, I see the whole thing as being junglism, and jungle and drum and bass are subgenres within that. But junglism is the way of life, in the same way that we talk about grime now as a way of life. So really you're having a whole subculture, a whole subsect of society, a whole group of people that were primarily black being excluded from clubs, being excluded from the media. And that lasted a very long time and still goes on today.
And one of the things that, as you're talking about that, one of the things you bring up in the book is this idea that it starts to become a business, right? That that they are influenced by the media, that they start thinking about this more as a business, and there's this move to mainstream. So you talk about the committee. So can you talk a little bit about that sort of move from this underground space, one where they could sort of avoid this public pressure, to one where they start to, where certain members at least start to sort of want to be a part of this mainstream culture?
Okay, I mean, the interesting thing about the junglism industry is it's a part of neoliberal capitalism. You know, really, it's no different to punk's DIY movement in that way. Punk's comes from the emerging neoliberal environment. And junglism is post-Thatcher, you know. So the idea that people were trying to build themselves, build their brand, build careers is not unusual, and actually it was very much of the era, very much it made sense. What was interesting to me, and the committee's kind of, sometimes people misread this as being me thinking it's a bad thing. Actually, the committee was really interesting, because what they were saying was a group of primarily black artists and DJs, producers and MCs saying, we've lived through a rave scene beforehand where people stole our music. You have producers who made number one hit singles that becomes attributed to somebody else. You have an environment where the biggest rave act of the era had a third member who is a black man who never got credited. So this was about people coming together and saying, we need to protect what's ours. We realise our own value. We realise our own power. We need to control things. Now, the downside of the controlling of things is you basically had a lot of men controlling things in their image. So it became a very negative environment for women. So you don't see a huge amount of female DJs coming through. Hardly any MCs. I think I can only think of one. You don't see many female producers. You see key people. So you've got Chemistry and Storm, very important in the development of metalheads, and both incredible DJs and producers in their own right. DJ Rap, one of the highest selling jungle artists of all time. But they were excluded from these meetings, from the committee. And one of the decisions that the committee made was to clamp down on certain promoters. So first of all, they start saying to people, we will not support you if you don't if you work for that promoter. And that promoter might be a female DJ's main source of income. So putting, so this happened to DJ Rap. So basically she's being told, in order to be supported by the scene or the committee, you have got to stop playing for that promoter who pay, who you make your main income from. Well, that creates an instant division. So this, I mean, it becomes quite a negative environment for women, I think. And but at the same time, the media have got their part to play because the media kind of ignored female DJs constantly. But going back to the committee tried to control everything. So they tried to control who was able to write about them. They tried to control who could take photographs. They tried to control who, which promoters were the right promoters, who were the right DJs, who were the right producers, who were the right MCs, which I kind of understand why, in terms of ethnicity and not having black music stolen again. But I think there was a sexism at the core of it. There was extremely negative. Ironically, I think now what the committee were trying to do back then, grime fully understands, and the grime scene really has emerged with that ideology that the committee was trying to push in terms of control, but not quite as much sexist control.
So one of the things that in your answer you brought up, and I wanted to ask you about it anyway, is metalhead. So you talk about a number of different labels, but one of the labels that you focus on and talk about is Metalheads and also the Sunday Session. So can you talk about the importance of Metalheads as a label and sort of what they did in the scene?
Well, I think it's worth remembering that when I wrote the book, Metalheads were probably at their peak. So, you know, if I was to fully revise the book, I might have a different perspective on them as a label now. But at that time, for an old person like me, they reminded me of 4AD, in that 4AD, you had to collect the set. You know, you bought your Cocteau Twins records and the Small Coil records for the artwork, and you had to have the set. Well, Metalheads had that same vibe about them, the same aesthetic. So every single track that came out, you had to have it. It all clicked, all the artwork fit together. It was all coming from the same space. It was kind of, I think, Metalheads was important in that it was laying down a lot of the ideas about branding. Branding an idea, branding a concept that we take for granted now. And I think labels like Metalheads are where you first start seeing that alongside the super clubs of the era. There were a number of internal problems with Metalheads. There's lots of arguments between its producers. Goldie is a person who's can be hot-headed. to say the very least. Unsurprisingly, a number of people had arguments with him. But really, I think the engine behind the label were Chemistry and Storm. And also, I'd say Goldie's manager, and I've forgotten his name right now. But they were the engine behind Metalheads. They really did shape the sound and the direction and the feel of the aesthetic of the label. The actual Sunday Sessions were amazing. There was a sense, I always talk about this music of always, it feels like you're walking into the future. Certainly the clubs, the best clubs always felt like this, and really Metalheads epitomised what was best about the drum and bass and jungle clubs, is that you walked in and the music you were hearing, well, it was 6 months away from being released for starters. So everything was fresh. In fact, by the time things were actually released, they felt old, which is kind of interesting in terms of accelerated culture. And you think about the era this is emerging in. There was interesting about Metalheads as well. You had a really mixed audience. So yes, you had your junglists there, and you had your old school drum and bass followers, but you also had a huge amount of Japanese people really incredibly excited by this music. In fact, the first version of the book was licensed to Japan, the best version I've ever seen. It was so beautifully done. I went to a number of clubs in Japan. Drum and bass was just so big there. You saw in Metalhead, you also saw a lot of kind of cool, famous people. but they were just there. Nobody cared. It's a bit like Brighton in England, that nobody cares about famous people because you trip over them all the time. Well, that's what it was a bit like in Metalheads. You're there for the music. You're there for the energy. You're there for the environment. You're not really there to see a famous person. I mean, David Bowie very famously went down there one night and nobody noticed him. You're there to dance. You're not there to look at people. So the great thing that I say in the book about Metalheads, about the Blue Note and the Sunday sessions at the Blue Note, is it felt like the future. The great thing for that area of London is it became a part of the gentrification of London and the warehouse spaces that were great free party spaces back then, you couldn't get for less than £4 million a piece now. It's a bit like Little Italy, you know, Soho in New York, all those areas that, you know, where the post-punk scene came from, where Moby used to live, where you'd literally be tripping over drug addicts in the doorway, and now you're tripping over A-list celebrities.
It's always how it works.
Isn't it just, yeah.
part of this too, you mentioned, I was going to say you mentioned Moby, which you did, but you mentioned Goldie. Right. And some of this success of this move to the sort of mainstream and this explosion seems to come from Goldie. You talk about his studio album, this having a really solid studio album versus the live performance. So can you talk a little bit about that ability to transition to this really solid studio album versus what often is just a scene that's often really known for those live performances of those DJs.
Sure. Well, I mean, the great thing I've already talked about the fact that drum and bass is very much about the single. The jungle is very much about the single. The idea of the dance floor is very much about the single. You're not looking for timelessness in a single. You're looking for the beat of the here and now. It's the zeitgeist of the heartbeat. And, The album wants to do a completely different thing. It's trying to be something that transcends the dance floor and remains with you forever. Really hard thing to do. And very few artists, even rock artists, actually, I think, achieve great albums. Now, I think Goldie, very much because of his producer, Rob Playford, on Timeless, created an exceptional drum and bass album. It's a bit too long. I'll be honest now, I don't ever listen to the whole thing anymore. But within that album, you hear there are so many flavors, so many styles. It draws on all those major influences and it puts it into a cohesive journey. There are other artists that achieve this in drum and bass and jungle. Four Hero, certainly on their album, Two Pages, an incredible album. And also, obviously, Ronnie Size represents, which I still to this day think is the finest album that came out of the whole scene. I know a lot of people disagree with me on that one. But these made that difficult transition. Often when drum and bass artists or junglists try to create albums, they got sucked into the Billy Cobham jazz funking. You know, we've got to show that we're true musicians here and be deeply musical. And they kind of move so far away from the musicianship of creating and shaping an electronic piece of music that they kind of often lost the essence of what their sound was about. They lost that dance floor energy. Groove Rider is a great example of that. His debut full-length album wasn't very good at all. It was just like jazz rock at times. And not done very, very well. Whereas his Prototype Years album that came out before it, which was the best of his singles, was immense because of just a series of singles. So this is a really difficult trick. And then Goldie tried to transfer what was an incredible album into the live environment. And what did he do? He went the groove route of employing lots of great musicians and turning it into a jazz odyssey. Musicians were great, but it was not the album. It was not what was great about Goldie and Rob Playford. Now, some of the guys that were involved with it are incredible, incredible players. He had fantastic DJs, producers. Cleveland Watkins, the MC, amazing. But as a live project, it was awful. And you know, one of those things where you get so excited about seeing something, because you know, so it's live, it's going to be a different version, it's going to be... But you expect the essence to still be there. It was terrible. It was awful. I'll go so far as to say is David Bowie did drum and bass better live than Goldie.
So
I'm going to get killed for saying that. So I know people are going to be really upset with me saying that.
I'll quickly move from it. Because sort of when you get to sort of the end, jungle drum and bass, sort of this scene really becomes international. You talk about Japan, you talk about this sort of growth and explosion and this move. So can you just share where you saw this, how this sort of continued, right? That it didn't end. It's a continuum. And sort of what you see happening now, but what you sort of saw after that, the sort of first edition of this book and where this sort of headed.
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing is to say that it never really went mainstream. It became mainstream media in that it was picked up and covered by the music press and the style press. But it didn't necessarily become a daily topic in the broadsheets or the early evening television programs. It wasn't mainstream in that way. And basically it didn't sell. On bottom line, it didn't sell in the same way, in the way that they expected it to do. You know, it's no Coldplay. But the impact it had globally, the influence it had globally was amazing. So if I look at the global scene, okay, so the music spread. There were clubs everywhere. I said, I went to clubs in Japan. I went to clubs in New York. In fact, just recently, I went back in October. I was at a club in Moscow, and so it really is a huge scene globally, a huge underground scene globally. But and I would say that anywhere I go to in the world, I can find a place that's playing jungle drum and bass. But the impact it had musically was phenomenal as well. So it does transfer back to Jamaica, for starters, for instance. So if you've got something that's influenced by dancehall, well, influence goes two ways. This idea of there being a one-way culture, this idea, this cultural imperialistic idea that music in Britain or America are forcing music on the rest of the world and the influence doesn't come back. Well, there are many way flows of influence going on all the time. And so you start seeing, for instance, in Jamaica, the bashment scene, bashment dancehall, clearly influenced and inspired by drum and bass and jungle. You start seeing the influence on people like Timbaland in his production. Listen to the early production of Khalees, Destiny's Child, that early, I don't really like to use the word urban, but it was marketed as urban, that urban R&B scene. A lot of those productions were very, very influenced by drum and bass. So you start seeing this different, its tentacles touching on those different things. And I've already mentioned David Bowie, but the rock scene was influenced as well. So you start seeing young bands coming through who are very inspired by drum and bass. So you've got some, you know, rock bands who are fusing the sounds. So it kind of mainstreams in that way. It influences in a number of ways. The other interesting thing within the UK, of course, I've already mentioned the committee's influence on grime. But in terms of music, well, Jungle has this really this first claim of Black British music aesthetic. It came from Britain. It didn't come from anywhere else. We had a hip hop scene that was inspired by America, but British hip hop didn't come from Britain. British reggae didn't come from Britain. This is the first music that was a British creation. So Black British music, it then inspires the garage scene. One of the interesting things that starts happening in drum and bass and jungle is drum and bass becomes very, not very sexy. It's not very good to dance to. Whereas jungle was, and there is, I talk about a race division, but I actually think there was more of a gender division starts to emerge. There are far more women in jungle and far more women going to the garage events, and a lot of the jungle DJs start DJing at garage events. And then you get the two-step sound. So the interesting thing emerging, you've got two-step garage. At the same time, you've got a form of drum and bass, which is almost entirely, it's almost hard to listen to, that it's so much so machine music, but that's also a two-step beat. So you've got two diametrically opposed forms of music that are both using the same groove. That then starts to influence, on the one hand, dubstep, and on the other hand, what the emergence of grime. The great thing and really interesting thing for me is through all this process, you see the MC being in the background and slowly coming to the fore, comes to the fore through jungle, becomes much more, even more to the fore in garage, and in grime is there at the front. So you see this transition from the back room producer, the bedroom producer, and the MC playing second fiddle, through to being, this is the MC's thing. So I do believe that jungle is the most important cultural phenomenon in British contemporary history. It is, for Black British music, what punk was to, I'd say, white British music. It was just pulling apart the rules, reconstructing things, deconstructing, reconstructing, and creating something that could only have emerged from a particular space in a particular time.
So we've been talking about this for a while, and about your book. And so I usually, my sort of final question, what I usually ask is if there's something you're working on now or any projects that you have going on that you sort of want to plug.
Wow. So I'm now going to look up at my ongoing board of work. So I'm currently writing a paper about grime. Grime and the political environment that it emerged from. I'm also writing a paper about the Russian fandom of the Prodigy, which is quite a unique fandom. I've got a paper that I'm writing about the loss of Islam from hip hop, how Islam was the unofficial religion of hip hop. And then almost it disappears and is replaced by consumerism. That's a very simplistic way of putting it, but it's kind of asking the question, where is Islam in hip-hop now? And I'm working on a book about the Prodigy. I've self-published a biography. I'm doing part two at the moment. I'm also working on an academic book about music journalism, music criticism. And what it is now. So I'm doing loads.
I was going to say, you've got lots of projects going on. There's lots of time now, right?
That's this summer. Actually, this has been an incredibly productive time, you know, without having to travel to and from work and all those meetings where you have to sit and listen to people waffle on. and suddenly they're 20-minute Zoom meetings. Suddenly I've got so much extra time, and I've been very productive with it. So I shouldn't say I'm enjoying this time, because actually I really want to go out to a club and again.
Yes, I mean, and I don't, yes, and that probably is not going to happen anytime soon.
I can't see it, no.
So, yeah, so you can just keep writing about them and writing about the club.
Yeah, hopefully my kids won't come to me and say, what was a club, Dad? But, of course, all the venues are going bankrupt here now, so they're all closing down.
Yes, we're seeing similar here in the US, and it'll just keep going, I think.
Well, I think maybe people will start putting on illegal raves and gigs again. Mm. But they already are. That's already happening here. So.
Yes. And there's talk about that. I'm in a university, you know, a small town, but was just talk yesterday at a meeting I was at, what happens if the students start having these like large gatherings that right now are not legal in the state. And how will the sort of university, even if it's off campus, deal with that kind of thing if it's more than 50 people at these large sort of gatherings and groups? So it'll be interesting to see.
It is interesting times, and from an ethnographic point of view, very interesting times.
Oh, yes. Well, it's been really great talking with you about this. Again, this is Martin James, who wrote State of Bass, The Origins of Jungle Drum and Bass. And this is Rebecca Buchanan for New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. Martin, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Right. Really enjoyed it.